This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest is T.V. Paul, who is the James McGill Professor of International Relations at McGill University in Montreal. His new book is The Warrior State, Pakistan in the Contemporary World. T.V., welcome to Berkeley.
Well, thank you for having me here.
You describe Pakistan as a garrison state. Explain to our audience what a garrison state is.
A garrison state focuses largely, its main purpose is defense, defined by the members of the military elite as well as those who support that conception. So the state is besieged from all sides, whether it is internal, external. The military is the most important function of the state, or protection. So the state creates institutions, state creates budgetary allocations. State is, the main purpose of the state is protection against predatory enemies who may destroy the state if you're not very careful. So this becomes deeply institutionalized, and as Laswell calls, those who specialize in the art of war are the most important members of the society. They get the best perks, best houses, you know, best allocations. Society worships them, treats them as important. And so all these create a mindset, even among the general public, that a country exists for protection and everything else should be secondary to it. Garrison states also tend to have control over the media, over the ideas that others propagate. And they are not known for democracy, obviously, as civilians won't have much control. Even if they allow civilians rule, they won't have some veto power. So that's part of the challenge of Pakistan.
And what in the case of a country like Pakistan, what are the consequences for internal development? How does it affect budgets for social welfare, mm-hmm. for those aspects of society that we see as crucial for creating a modern nation state?
The typical budgetary allocation, you look at the webpage of Pakistani ministries or various ministries, suggests that they're talking about 3% of the GDP, which is a very wrong number because we have to look at the percentage of the national budget that goes into military and military-related functions. And then, of course, the opportunity cost involved in not having the land reforms, you know, that kind of stuff. But the number one thing is that estimates vary from various phases in the last 66 years. I talk about the defense expenditures varying from 60 to 40% to 30%, you know. And right now, of the GDP, and of the governmental expenditure, GDP is reasonably big, but the problem is Pakistan doesn't collect taxes. So it doesn't, he cannot use that as the big measure. I would also say that they don't include nuclear energy development, nuclear weapons development, pensions of many of the military staff. As a result, if you add up all that, the military expenditure should be quite high of the Pakistani national expenditure.
And on this business about not collecting taxes, you say that less than 2% of the Pakistanis pay income tax.
I based that on a 2010 report of New York Times. But since then, it has gone down to 0.7%, yes, last year. The estimates are really bad on this. They have sales tax, customs tax, and other things. But even when you add all those taxes, it's still under 10%, 9.1% of the GDP is collected as in tax forms. So as a consequence, Pakistan is able to maintain a certain kind of state structure. But it needs foreign aid to pay off the debts, and it gets into crisis often, especially the military expenditures and the weapon systems that it needs. That's where the role of the United States and IMF, World Bank, Saudi Arabia, China, all the allies come into play. It's not a big amount, you know, if you put it as part of the ratio of the GDP, but it's a big amount part of the governmental budget. So this is a problem that I discuss subsequently, why that is hurting Pakistan.
And talk a little more about the privileges domestically of the military, because as part of the perks, the soldiers, the retired soldiers, are given land, and so then that makes them opponents of any kind of land reform that would achieve greater equality in the country.
Right. This is a bit like a garrison state. You know, you had that in the European system, the Wilhelmine, Germany's, and others, and same in some Latin American countries. The military becomes a major player in preventing social revolution, social reforms. Part of it is in the Pakistani context. As far as we know, many of the top tier get a lot of land and other privileges when they retire. Now, some of them will dispute, we don't get exactly the exact acres of land, but they do get a lot of privileges, and they have these privileges give them a higher strata even after in the society even after they retire. Now, they also are members of many corporations. They go into executive boards, as well as they have foundations. These foundations really are running many of the functioning industries of Pakistan, their service sector, their road transportation, disaster relief, etc. Some of them are necessary because otherwise the private sector or other kind of supply is not there. So the army has a big advantage. You know, they have the vehicles, they have the expertise. So that when there is an earthquake, you know, they're the ones coming in. But so by privileging them as the landed aristocracy, as the industrial sector, you know, they control quite a bit of that, generate this sort of momentum that they don't have a great incentive to privatize things, let it go, you know. And obviously you need an entrepreneurial class, which is missing as well.
The Pakistan, parts of Pakistan have been subject to great flooding, and climate change is going to make that worse. And so this garrison state mentality, does it contribute to not creating the infrastructure and preparation for the future that's going to be very prone to disaster?
Very much so. Pakistan has apparently built very few dams and very few canals since the British left. Punjab is where a lot of canals are there, water distribution. Some they have. As a result, water is not distributed properly or collected during the monsoon season, which is 3 months, 4 months. So water is coming in big gushes from the Indus and its tributaries, and then flood into these plains, you know, Punjab or Sindh and various parts of northwest. And as a result, the water is wasted, and then there is big water shortage in the summer. And the water is not distributed to some provinces, such as Sindh. You know, the farmers of Punjab collect whatever. They are the granary of Pakistan, too. And so this generates interprovincial tensions and partly contributing to the conflict they have with Sindh and Balochistan and places like that. So the water management is a big issue. They blame it on India for building dams, but there's a lot of water coming in during certain season, but the collection mechanism is very primitive, as far as I know.
So as a result of being a garrison state, you have weak political parties and not adequate representation of the different ethnic groups. So one of the problems that Pakistan has had is building a national, cohesive country where the different ethnic groups don't want to part with the Pakistan identity. So they can't maintain the integrity of the country.
In the book, I start off by one of the anecdotes of Ghafar Wali Khan's famous statement. I have been a Pashtun for 4,000 years, a Muslim for 1,400 years, and a Pakistani for 40 years. Mm. He made that in the 60s statement.
And the Pashtuns, we should explain to our audience, are one of the largest groups in Pakistan.
They're divided between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah.
So Pakistan's approach has been national integration through first using certain Islamic ideas, but coercive approach, top-down. In other words, federalism was not conceived as one way to give representation to these various groups. They thought Islam will somehow glue it together. But who's Islam? There are different Islams. There is Sunni, there is Shia, there is Ahmadi, there is Ismaili. And so ethnicity sometimes becomes more important than the kind of religious identity. And they try to impose Urdu as a language, but which doesn't work with other different groups. And then the treatment of minorities, that's including Muslim minorities like Ahmadi, they were banned as a non-Muslim, they're treated as non-Muslims, 2 million of them. So this happened under Mr. Bhutto's period. All this create intense hostility toward the mainstream, you know, Sunni-led, Punjabi-led elite. And Pakistan has not been successful in bridging the different gaps. And Bangladesh, the bifurcation itself shows the inability of, you know, putting together this coalition that was needed for national integration.
It's very important, and we're going to talk about the military and geostrategic implications of this in a minute, but let's talk here now about Pakistan seeing itself as an Islamic state. Mm. And so this is very important on the one hand for the domestic identity. So you've just told us that it's one kind of Sunni Islam which is favored, but it's also made Pakistan susceptible to a particular kind of aid. I'm talking here about Saudi aid for supporting the educational system the Wahhabi view of Islam. Talk a little about that, because it contributes to what some might call as the disaster of Pakistani education, which it primarily emphasizes religious beliefs and not technology and science.
And liberal ideas.
Yeah.
Well, you know, initially Pakistan was actually, their educational system was reasonably liberal in the sense, under Ayub Khan's period, etc., they had a little bit more openness. But Pakistan never spent any money on education, less than 2% of the GDP. And that means there's a big demand, and then the madrasas fill up. That not all madrasas are bad, by the way. I mean, we have to differentiate. But Saudis entered the picture, especially in the context of Zia-ul-Haq's Islamization program. And they provided considerable funding to various madrasas to teach a certain kind of education, which, as you said, don't include the critical aspects of, you know, science and technology or even the liberal mentality. And worst of all is the history of Pakistan is taught in these schools, including state schools. There are other very, very deviated fashion. So, in other words, there is no talk about the 4,000 or 5,000-year-old history of South Asia or anything much about Hinduism. For many of the Pakistanis come from the Hindu tradition. They don't want to even think about it that way. And the eclectic beauty of South Asia, which is essentially the intermingling of different religions, Hinduism, Islam, then you have before that Buddhism, you have Sikhism. All these eclectic approaches are very deep in the South Asian civilizational milieu. So this sort of education has given a very convoluted view of what Pakistan is. And, you know, so a lot of talk about the invasions and how they made this place a better place.
That is Islam.
Islam, or the Islamic invaders, not Islam per se.
Yeah.
And so it really generates the mindset of, you know, and glorification of war. So without that kind of focus on science and technology, Pakistan's youth is not trained to make use of the globalized world economy. India did a little bit better, although very poorly in primary and other education areas, because they created a certain sectors of higher learnings. That those are the people who work in Silicon Valley and places like that. Pakistan doesn't have any of that. And so the state has not been able to raise the profile of education and bring in science and technology, engineering schools, etc. This is one thing I keep telling, you know, why don't you start 100 engineering colleges straight away somehow? Because otherwise, where will you put these, you know, youth that's growing up? Where will they go for jobs and things like that? So this lack of focus on education has hurt them, and they are getting money from outside to run a certain kind of schools that is not 21st century educational system.
And that would be from the Saudis?
Yeah, quite a bit. And the Saudis should have done a lot better by giving them. Saudis themselves put emphasis on science and technology in some of their universities. Why don't they give some of that money to set up science and technology institutions in Pakistan? You know, that is the big question. It's not actually Saudis alone. There are foundations within Saudi, private money too. So,
At the core of your analysis of why the garrison state in Pakistan endures is the notion of a geostrategic curse. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But in understanding Pakistan, history is very important. You emphasize that, and again, on the one hand, it's the Islamic tradition in South Asia, and its association with Islamic invasions in earlier periods, and on the other hand, it's the emergence of Pakistan at the time of the independence of India and Pakistan from the British Empire. Let's talk about that history, because you see that history as setting the stage for the geostrategic curse. What is it about the independence of India and Pakistan that we should know?
Well, I think that is one of my big arguments here, saying that we should not look at this competition, rivalry, purely as a military rivalry just for territory or Kashmir or whatever. It's a deeper rivalry because it involves a history, with civilizational history. I argue that for about 1,000 years, Muslim rulers controlled South Asia, at least major parts of it. The British came and then they started slowly penetrating. And the Mughal Empire, the last one, was the most successful one and really did a lot of good things. You think about their civilization was as equal, as good as many of the other contemporary civilizations. And they became part of India, you know, the Mughals, especially Akbar and all, very eclectic, indeed, very tolerant, very highly regarded rulers. So 1857, when the first mutiny, as the Brits call it, or Indians call it the First War of Independence, was led by Muslim princes in northern India, supported by Hindu soldiers, etc. This was a very brutal affair. It killed a lot of locals as well as the British soldiers. And the British suppressed it. That means East India Company repressed the whole thing and afterwards sidelined the Muslim rulers. So then they started supporting the Hindu upper caste for various jobs they were giving. So this is in the context where the Muslim underrepresentation and loss of power, loss of sense of dignity and status, that's when they started to talk about we need to resurrect the kind of status we had. So Pakistan was viewed by many as sort of resurrecting the Mughal Empire in a different way. And they thought they would get entire Punjab, entire Kashmir, parts of Kashmir definitely, and Bengal. That would have given them almost equal status. But it didn't.
With India.
With India. It didn't happen, partly because the population was divided in that way, Hindus majority in this part of Punjab and Bengal. And so this is when Jinnah called it a moth-eaten Pakistan.
And Jinnah, explain who Jinnah is. He was one of the founding fathers.
He's the one leader of the Muslim League who disenchanted with the Congress, started the Muslim League. So when they're emerging, they are considering themselves as equal to India, co-equals, parity. So, and then the idea is to achieve military parity. Of course, India has more material capacity, but strategic parity. And the parity was achievable because during the Cold War, you have the United States adopted Pakistan, and the Western countries always hyphenated India, Pakistan. And this they gave them a big, bloated understanding of their importance in the world. And, of course, the Afghan wars, etc. And since the Cold War ended, this has changed dramatically. The U.S. is embracing India, you know, liberalization, etc. And the gap is widening. India was also kind of basket case when it comes to economic arena. Actually, Pakistan was doing better for the initial period of the 50s and 60s, partly due to American aid and other policies that you followed. So the contest is about that we, they need to equalize power, and equalization is not possible. And that is what is happening today.
Okay. So before we get into that, and we will do that in a minute, I want to go back to independence, basically. And I think you point out, and this is very important, that in the history of India and Pakistan, that the Congress Party did not support the Brits in World War II.
Yes.
And the Muslim League, headed by Jinnah, did.
Yes.
And the consequence of that was that at the last minute, mm-hmm. the Brits decide to give the Islamic population a separate state.
That's one factor, not the only factor. Yeah.
But that's very important.
Yes.
The way Fortuna mm-hmm. or choices made by political leaders
yes.
Impacts.
Indian historians don't consider that as an important variable or factor.
But you do.
I do, because I think that we have to look at the British mindset. In 1942, Gandhi initiated Quit India Movement. Gandhi was very frustrated with the Brits because what happened was he supported the Boer War. He supported World War I, and the Indian soldiers were the largest contingent in both wars, all these wars. Yet the British were not following up their promises of self-rule, etc. So during World War II, this was a peak of Hitler's rise in Europe. Britain would have collapsed. So unfortunately, the Congress Party thought this was not a good time to support them. Part of it was, I don't talk a lot about it, is the way Churchill and others were treating India. They were getting food out of Bengal, causing major famines in India, and taking food to the European front when India didn't have enough food. So all this created intense hostility, and Gandhi initiated that program. Whereas Jinnah supported British efforts, at least outwardly. They didn't do much. Indian soldiers, by the way, fighting on various fronts. So this is the context I'm referring to, that why the British thought that Pakistan may be a better bet when two states become independent for Western defense. And that was clearly coming out of some of the new stuff that we know, Mountbatten and others talk about, or British military talking about why these people are a sturdy group. They are needed for our defense, especially in the context of the Soviet Union.
One other point that I want to draw out of you, which is in the book, which is the British strategy for dealing with the colonies in South Asia mm-hmm. and dealing with the different peoples, had an impact in the lines that were drawn when the war ended mm-hmm. and the kind of rule that was adopted, so that And here, what one important point is, the Pashtuns were divided between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah. This was one of the biggest mistakes of the British, creating these lines where people like Kashmir, again, you know, sort of to some extent later on caused that problem. But Pashtun, that should not have happened. They should have somehow managed to create either a semi-autonomous country or something. But giving one side of the Pashtun population to Pakistan, the other side to Afghanistan, was something they did rather without thinking too much about. And obviously, this is continuing to fester. And this may be one of the reasons why Pakistan supports Taliban, to make sure the Pashtuns don't become together and fight against Pakistan. So that way it is a kind of divide and rule approach the British had in South Asia. The British adopted a very clever strategy of divide and rule. They will support anybody who will support them, but if the moment you are not with them, they will divide them up with their own. And communalism became a part of that heritage. And the British were not great managers of communal identity. They did a few good things for India, by the way, infrastructure and things like that, English language. But the problem of the British rule was it was not a developmental approach. The Japanese actually did much better in Korea, Taiwan, and all, except that it was very repressive. Britain was not that repressive, but of course it was.
Now, at the core of your book is an analysis that tries to answer the question, why does Pakistan remain a garrison state? Why does it, you call it a warrior state mm-hmm. also? And at the core of your argument is the idea of a geostrategic curse. Mm. What is that, and why does it help us understand the resiliency, the continuation mm. of this configuration?
I draw that idea from a very powerful literature called Resource Curse, as well as Foreign Aid Curse. That's developmental sociologists and economists use. If you have too much resource, only one resource, oil, for instance, the country will depend on that. they will not develop a diversified economy. They will buy off populations in such a way that civil society will be controlled. Democracy won't develop or very poorly developed mechanisms. So I apply that in the context of Pakistan and to some extent Egypt is another case, and the Philippines under Marcos. I argue that if a country gets too much support from external entanglements, great power conflicts, that elite has little incentive to do anything else to diversify the income sources. So Pakistan's case, of course, the aid is not a big part of the GDP, but it is a big part of, as I said, the governmental resources as well as the military's resources. And so Pakistan has been lucky that it is in a very important part of the world. During the Cold War, it was a frontline state against the Soviet Union. You know, the U.S. spy planes used to fly from Peshawar.
And that's where Gary Powers took off in the U-2.
Yes. And then after the 60s, that became problematic with the Pakistan fighting India. And for a short period, there was a kind of U.S. lack of interest. But then you have the Afghan invasion by the Soviet Union, starts another round of big U.S. interest and funding, and then another round after 9/11. In between, you have support from China, you have Saudi Arabia, and quite a few other Western countries as well. Islamic countries too, from the... So enough money is coming in to just sustain the state. It doesn't have to do the deep reforms, land reforms, export-oriented markets, investment, attracting foreign investment. It can survive, you know. And there is no big middle class. So that's my argument, that that's a curse, because that doesn't allow you to change as other countries have done in the world.
And you're saying that this relationship with outside powers, some of them great powers, who have an interest unrelated to Pakistan's own interests, to put up money, arms, and so on. And so you're creating a rentier class.
Yeah, very much.
Right. And it's different actors, China on the one hand at some time, the United States on another, who are motivated to keep the aid flowing.
Yes.
Now, let's go back to this relationship with India, because you've already pointed in that direction. So given the history, given the time of independence and the failure of India to keep the bargain about where Kashmir would go after there was independence. Talk a little about that, because that's very important.
There was no real bargain about Kashmir, which is another very...
Okay.
The bargain was that Kashmir's ruler was given the right to determine. Ruler was a Hindu Maharaja or prince, whereas the population majority are Muslims, although you have a very substantial minority of Hindus and Buddhists. So when the ruler was not willing to go either way, he wanted to become independent state. There was an invasion from the Pakistani northwestern region by the tribal forces supported by Pakistan. And they almost reached Srinagar, and then the Hindu Maharaja appealed to India to intervene, to protect. That's when Nehru's India sends troops and pitched battle occurred, and then they managed to push them up to that line of control. That is where today is about one-third in the Pakistani control, the rest in India side. And the Kashmiris themselves initially were not very sure what they wanted to do. Sheikh Abdullah was the Muslim ruler, wanted to maintain some kind of relationship with India, and he will back off, want independence, you know. Obviously, there was no clear evidence that the people would have gone with Pakistan, but Pakistan obviously claims it would have been naturally to be part of theirs.
And so this was never settled? And it continued.
It's never settled. There was India offered a plebiscite, never held it. What it's saying that unless Pakistan withdraws from all its areas, India will not withdraw. And that now the population wants independence, both sides. And neither India nor Pakistan wants to give Kashmiris independence. And without an independent state, they are not going to be happy, because that will potentially become a Balochistan or an Afghanistan. It's a strategic location. They're in the wrong place, unfortunately.
But the Kashmiris.
They are strategically, the three powers are, you know, converging, and Russia too. But they don't have much resource either. There's tourism mostly, and that has to come from India. But the Indian policies have unfortunately hurt India's position, quite a bit of repression since the 80s, 89s. And then the Pakistanis are sending in trained guerrillas and groups to fight with the local insurgents. So this insurgency has been going on, although recently it has subsided. So
history, the events at independence, the Islamic tradition in Pakistan lead to a situation of where this conflict between India and Pakistan, a series of wars, are a defining feature for Pakistan's military's perception of the strategic challenges they face. And they are confronted with the fact that from their view, they are India's equal or should be its equal, and therefore they seek parity. And what is the dilemma that poses for them, and how do they address that problem?
Well, the problem is they're seeking a kind of parity based on military instruments. So then now they got nuclear weapons, actually more weapons than India, and they're deploying short-range missiles on the border with India. The problem is economically they didn't put the money into the real place where the competition should be. That is economic equality. Instead, they're relying on this traditional instrument. And their biggest challenge is it's 1 to 7, 1 to 8, the major parameters of material capabilities. And it's changing, growing.
That is India over
Pakistan. Yeah. And so this cannot be easily bridged until they become an economic power like Korea did. But they never put emphasis on that. That's because I talk about the ideas that drive Pakistani elite somewhat dated, you know, the military garrison state ideas. And they need to become a trading state, developmental state, as Korea did. That's what I'm pushing for them in this book.
So they make a choice over a long period that makes them a warrior state, garrison state. But they're confronted with the reality that they're very great asymmetries in the military realm. So this then pushes them to, you identify three factors. Talk a little about them. Nuclear weapons first.
Weaponry, different weaponry from the beginning, qualitative weaponry.
Yeah.
Strategy.
Yeah.
That include asymmetric strategy or using non-state actors. And then
terrorists, basically.
We want to call them.
Yeah,
I'm politically correct here.
Okay, yeah.
Other one is alliance relationship, great power, China, you know, is a big equalizer. But none of them can really keep this parity going forever because of the big differences. And as a result, they have become very proactive. They have an offensive doctrine. They will strike when it is useful for their purposes. Mm-hmm. In other words, if India is vulnerable, they think they can strike. So 1965, Pakistan starts the war under Bhutto's leadership, actually, because India was weakened after the 62 war with China. 1999, General Musharraf strikes in Kargil, saying that this is a window of opportunity.
This is at the Kashmir border.
Yes,
yeah.
Kargil is a hills on the Indian side of Kashmir. Then the Mumbai attacks or parliament attacks. Of course, Pakistan would deny they have no official connection, but some connection definitely existed. We know ISI was controlling the Mumbai attackers through various telephone conversation, etc. Now, the problem is that when they engage in this sort of coercive behavior, the Indians become very strident. They also have no desire to compromise. But they think that the Pakistani military planners think that the only way to engage India is to have what you call put pressure on them, you know, the pressure tactics. And now my argument is that that shows it's a failure of diplomacy and that giving this veto power to India until you solve all our territorial problems, including Kashmir, we will not be having even trade relationship with you. Although there are different reasons for not having a trade relationship because they don't have great things to export to India. So the problem is that they put all these things into one basket, military security, but they're not getting security or economic prosperity. They need to follow Korea and Taiwan.
Which is a trading state.
Trading state, developmental state, at the same time, garrison states, to some extent. Of course,
yeah.
They are now democratic states.
Yeah. So, but let's go back now, because when you say to achieve parity using military instruments, you go for a nuclear weapons program. Mm-hmm. So in that particular case, what Bhutto, the father, decides after one of the engagements with India, one of the wars,
71.
We're going to go for a nuclear program, and A.Q. Khan then creates a kind of globalized empire, gathering all of the materials and so on. And you're suggesting that the U.S. or parts of the U.S. government knew this was going on and didn't stop it.
No. The U.S., even under Reagan's period, was every year certifying that Pakistan was not seeking nuclear weapons. Part of the reason, without that congressionally mandated certification, they wouldn't give any aid to Pakistan. So they needed Pakistan's support to fight the Mujahideen. So during this Yaul-Haq period, the nuclear weapon was accelerated. The U.S. knew almost everything, but could not do or would not do anything. But the worst part was, from the U.S. point of view, whether they knew enough of the A.Q. Khan network that was supplying these things to North Korea, Iran, Iraq, etc. I don't know the full story, but obviously it was going on for 3-4 years, and the U.S. did not do enough, as far as we know, to stop it. Although towards the end it did. But as I argue in the book, hardly anybody is in prison over that. Mm-hmm. There's only 3 people who were indicted.
So acquiring nuclear weapons and building and continuing to build a large arsenal and adopting a first use doctrine, essentially, an offensive doctrine, Pakistan was trying to secure its position vis-a-vis India.
Right.
Okay. Secondly, another instrument that was very useful was the use of these, we can call them radical Islamic groups.
Jihadist groups.
Who could evolve into full-blown terrorism, even global terrorism, as a way to affect the result in Kashmir, and then later to build what the Pakistanis call strategic depth in Afghanistan.
Well, one should distinguish the goals of some of these groups and the Pakistani state itself.
Yeah,
I don't want to call the Pakistani state has so much grand ambition. Some of them do. But some of these groups would like to create an Islamic emirate.
Yeah.
That may include not just Kashmir, but many other parts of that.
Right.
But the Pakistani state is obviously found this is a very useful instrument, a state or parts of the state, especially in the context of the Soviet withdrawal, and a lot of these folks trained were available for fighting this war in Kashmir. So they created different cells and different groups. And only after 9/11, under U.S. pressure, they put some checks on them. But even then, they renamed these as groups and, you know, Jaish-e-Mohammed and all that. Now something else is known for. But hardly anybody is arrested or put in jail or anything. Mm-hmm. They are operating. At the same time, they now have become a very powerful force within.
Within
Pakistan, the Pakistan Taliban in particular. They want to convert Pakistan as a truly Islamic state, as they consider.
That is the groups that Pakistan nurtured
initially for
different purposes, limited purposes, have essentially become a blowback on Pakistan itself as these groups evolve.
Right. They realize that Pakistani state is a very weak state. They don't have good counter-terrorism capacity. So by creating terror, they are hoping that Pakistan will adopt more and more Sharia laws, convert into a truly Islamic state, and then wage jihad wherever they can. So all these really have generated this intense conflict in society, which has great potential. This is what I am trying to push, that they need to think of their potential in their youth, get them the training and the global involvement, and encourage China to treat them like U.S. treated Korea. China is treating them more like an ally to balance India. And so this has been a rather drawback of Pakistan. Slowly they are thinking, at least some very influential people are thinking, but it is not sufficient. They need a big change, big push for transforming their policies.
So the key to the geostrategic curse is that outside great powers also enter this game.
Yes.
So, for example, the U.S. Wants to push back the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So we want to support the Mujahideen, the Islamic fighters, and we do that through Pakistan. We have a goal of stopping the Soviets. But Pakistan is willing to participate in that, but it has other goals. Because while this is going on, it is using Islamic groups, jihadist groups, radical groups to stir up the situation in Kashmir.
That happened subsequently, though.
We're talking about a historical evolution where the actors change their motives and the people who think they are in control are not. Mm-mm. So the U.S. thinks it's controlling Pakistan's support of our war, our covert war against the Soviets. Mm. But in fact, Pakistan has other interests.
Mm. Well, it has hurt Pakistan in a big way. If you look at the big picture, the U.S. treats it as more like a transactional relationship. You provide us this thing, we give you money. And so they have the incentive to play double games and, you know, keep going as much they can milk the U.S. U.S. never had a long-term understanding of Pakistan, especially the elite. And they didn't develop a push for trade, investment. Initially, they did. So it was very difficult to create this sustainable relationship. Aid never creates equals, whereas trade does. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was the Pakistanis have high expectations of the U.S., treating them as equals. But the U.S. does not, because you are a recipient of our aid, you know. And this is part of the challenge, the psychological problem the U.S. has with Pakistan. Pakistanis hate the U.S., partly because we put conditions on them, do this thing, that thing, you know, follow our lead. But there is no depth to that relationship. Whereas we have Korea or Taiwan, we have very deep depth, you know, which means we are investing there, trading there. Suddenly, I noticed in the U.S., Pakistan strategic dialogue trade has appeared as a topic. It should have been from day one.
And what's important here, so one of the groups that the Pakistanis supported was the Taliban, basically, in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's a different Taliban, yeah.
And we should clarify this. So the Afghan Taliban, they support. Mm. But over time, what emerges is a Pakistani Taliban, which has different goals than the Afghan.
They may have some links, too. But right now, it seems like the Afghan Taliban wants to conquer Afghanistan. And the Pakistani Taliban wants to conquer Pakistan and create an Islamic state. There may be that grand ambition of both Talibans. But the Afghan Taliban, as you know, is starting to emerge as a very vicious group. And this is the number one fear now. Will Pakistan continue supporting that Taliban against the democratically elected government, which, by the way, had an interesting election? Apparently, it was a fair election, participated by a large majority of the electorate. And if the government or president comes in, will he be allowed to run this country?
Pakistan.
Or Pakistan, outsiders too.
Yeah.
And so I think the big challenge is to create a condition whereby the legitimately elected Afghan government be given the right to function and given all the support and not to be threatened constantly by Taliban. And there Pakistan plays a big role. If it wants to change, it can. This is the time to change.
Right. So let's go over this because it's very complicated. So what you have is a search by Pakistan for parity with India, which leads to what you call a truncated asymmetry, where military instruments are the primary vehicle for dealing with the threat which Pakistan sees as coming from India. Mm-hmm. And that involves embracing a nuclear weapons, embracing jihadist groups that evolve over time and move away from their original goals, split off, and actually some of these groups begin to pose a threat to the Pakistani state, although that was never their intention. Meanwhile, outside actors are the third element of the truncated, the tools of truncated asymmetry, and they, this outside aid, the U.S. being a key actor here, is given, and China, is given because the great powers have different goals, which they try to achieve through Pakistan.
Exactly. It's a very useful ally for that purpose.
Yeah. So the logic of this system and the way it continues to operate. So, for example, this system was operating when our concern was the threat from the Soviet Union after the invasion of Afghanistan. But it continued to operate when the adversary for the U.S. changed and it became terrorist.
Yes, and it could evolve again because if the adversary, Taliban, reemerges and the U.S. needs to return in some fashion, who else is there to support? Pakistan will be needed. And so it's a very tricky geopolitical quagmire, if you want to call it.
Yeah.
And we need very creative policies to get out of it.
Okay, so what will break up the logic of this system that you've identified where outside actors, the Pakistanis, have interest in seeing its continuation? Because you're saying that there is a domestic institutional structure in Pakistan, and we haven't even talked about the ISI.
Well,
explain briefly what they are. But
it's
what
the military intelligence wing of the military, which acts like a state within a state,
and they have been the mentors, the supporters,
power brokers,
of these actors who have become terrorists.
Which, by the way, happened during the first this offensive against the Soviet Union. The U.S. helped to create that, CIA especially. But let me come to this, when will and how will change happen?
Yeah.
If you look at other examples of change happen, it's basically a small group of elite. Soviet Union under Gorbachev. Then you have Brazil, all the countries, Indonesia, civilians especially, with a very modern understanding of we need to become liberalized trade. South Africa, all these places we thought change will never happen. It did happen because very courageous group of people, decision makers, said we need to engineer change. Of course, every society member will not be with us, but we need to initiate certain policies that will generate the support later on. And here, that is what is needed. If you want to have change, the current government of Nawaz Sharif should appoint very progressive Pakistanis from abroad too as members of the coalition cabinet, try to engage the military and try to restrain their, kind of garrison state approach. Engage in education reform. Engage in textbook reform, engage in land reform, and try to become a major trading state. Start engineering colleges, economic free zones, bring the Chinese investment, and of course, some security is needed. But don't wait for all the territorial disputes to be resolved. Until then, we won't do any of these things I'm mentioning. That's a big disastrous move because the country will not progress. It will be stuck in what it is. It will end up playing these double games to get as much handouts from these great powers. So this realpolitik is hurting them, the kind of realpolitik, which is 19th century realpolitik. We need to move on to the 21st century.
What's interesting here is your argument about what's going on now is so compelling that it creates the base for an argument to say, yes, but what is the ignition? What will make the change that is necessary happen? And I is it outside aid? Because all of the American aid goes to support the military.
A large part of it, some are for development.
Yeah.
Too.
So what you know where you want to go. So the question is, what is going to be the bridge from the system you're describing to the ideal you're proposing?
Yes. See, crises. 1991, India was under a major financial crisis. You know, they had only $1 billion to pay the debt of service. So they had to collect their gold from Reserve Bank of India's basement facilities, bunkers, and midnight they took a flight, flew to London so that they could pay off the debt. This was a very humiliating experience. Without that crisis, India would not have initiated liberalization. I'm not saying it's a perfect liberalization, yeah, but it did wonders in terms of at least the growth for a period of time. Now, Pakistan is not allowed to have a crisis because we are so afraid Pakistan will collapse.
Yeah.
And therefore, IMF comes straight away. Recently, $6.7 billion. U.S., Saudi Arabia, $1.7 each other. And it's pacified, bombing, giving them the kind of aspirin to maintain their situation. And so all the discussion is about how to overcome this little crisis for now, but not the big change. So the question is, shouldn't there be a discussion about, okay, what else is needed to make this country not dependent on this handout from international agencies, which they are not really grants, by the way. Some of them are debt, like they have to pay back. And that's hurting them. It's like this cycle of debt and indebtedness. So the strategy has to be coming out of this pressure
from the outside.
Outside and inside. And the elite thinking that we need to change, as Gorbachev's team thought, in order to become a better economic power. And that is an ideational change that is also a material change. But the outsiders can help, people who have some influence there. And China is one of the number one. I don't think they do much in terms of influence.
You're suggesting that crisis would help in a way, but unfortunately, the situation is so militarized,
right,
that there seems to be a real danger that, yes, an unintentional war could break out.
And it's a nuclearized country,
yeah,
so we have a lot of reasons not to let it slide into a major crisis. But how long you can use that argument to continue this sort of situation, which is not changing the country for the better, no?
Yeah.
So that is sort of my...
Well, and then the other possibility is an environmental crisis,
which is slowly happening.
Yeah.
But the problem with the environmental crisis is that they're slow. And unless you have a big, you know, tsunami led to Aceh conflict resolution by the Indonesians. But in this case, the big floods as well as the earthquake, people thought might push them to a more... reconciliation, or, you know, with the different groups, a change of policy. I don't think it's sufficient. You know, crisis comes, I mean, environmental crisis comes, and the next few months later, you know, they somehow manage to settle that problem. And then it is not the people who are hurt are the real poor. They're not the organized sector. They're not fighting for a change because of this environmental crisis.
One final question. What is it that you think the U.S. should do that would make a difference in transforming Pakistan, even though this is a problem primarily for the Pakistanis?
The U.S. should definitely include trade and investment experts who can advise them, engage in every discourse you have, and make some conditions that, you know, we are willing to support you, and make conditional changes to certain sectors where things can be done, education, spending, technical institutions, you know, training some Pakistanis here, but then taking them back to train their schools, etc. And U.S. should also try to encourage Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries where it has a lot of power to change their policies. The U.S. cannot let Pakistani elite to control the whole agenda the way they have been. This bargaining is not very smooth. There are interesting books on it, how Pakistan negotiates. And I think it is important to start looking at the fundamentals of this relationship and whether we can create a long-term strategic approach to making this country a good power, good state. It has the potential. It is not doomed to be a failure, you know. So, but policy engineering is needed. And the U.S. cannot leave this to military people or pure political scientists alone. We need expertise, you know, people who know about development and the kind of strategies that they need. And then they try to influence their mindset about how to go about it.
Well, on that hope for the future, TV, thank you for your book, and thank you for taking the time to come on our program.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.